This is The Guardian.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. As rain batters much of eastern Australia, and catastrophic flooding has left almost 500,000 people across New South Wales under evacuation orders, at least 14 people have died, with many more still missing.
More family tragedies are emerging in the state's flood crisis. The death toll in Lismore has now risen to 4.
As lives are lost and property destroyed, scientists have handed down the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report.
Nearly half of humanity is living in the danger zone now. Many ecosystems are at the point of no return now.
Described as the bleakest warning yet and an atlas of human suffering, the report outlines how human actions are closing an ever-narrowing window to a secure and livable future.
Every bit of warming matters, and the longer you wait, the more you will pay later.
Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Queensland correspondent Ben Smee about how we report on severe weather events in a climate emergency. It's Friday, the 4th of March. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
And good morning, Ben, and welcome to your first appearance on the Newsroom edition of Full Story.
Good morning. Very good to be here.
Lenore and Ben, you've both lived through floods. I wonder, Lenore, if you could just start and tell us what it feels like to be in that situation.
Well, I've never actually been flooded, so I'm very fortunate in that regard. But I grew up in Brisbane, so I do remember the 1974 Brisbane flood. I was a very young girl. I remember Dad taking me to this vantage point beside the Brisbane River where we could see the river, and it had broken its banks. It looked like 3-4 times wider than it usually did. And it was just this raging brown torrent. I remember seeing, you know, pieces of furniture like lounge chairs and things just zooming past in the water. And then afterwards, my brownie guide troop went around in my dad's Hiace van with tea and coffee for, it wasn't called the Mud Army then, but, you know, the people doing cleanup. So I remember that smell and the looks on people's faces as all their possessions were on their front curb. And then I remember the 2011 flood. I happened to be back in Brisbane for a friend's father's funeral, and I'd left my young daughter on the other side of the river with my parents, and that kind of panic of watching the river rise and thinking, I got to get out of here. I got to get back over that river before the bridges go under and the roads are cut. I mean, they are tiny sideline experiences compared with what tens of thousands of people have gone through this week. But I do just remember the power and the destruction of flood water and that sort of post-flood devastation.
And Ben, you're living through it in the past week while also reporting on it. How does that feel?
It has been a really interesting experience, I think, from the point of view of not just, okay, this is my job, I have to go out and talk to people about what they're living through, but you're living through it yourself. You know, those days here where the rain on the tin roof just kept coming and coming and coming. And then sort of subsequent to that, you know, the flooding is quite literally down the bottom of my hill. I live halfway up a hill. We were really fortunate not to be flooded out, but there were homes down the bottom that were flooded and there were people who had to be rescued. So when on Sunday morning, you actually then have to go out and start to kind of get a sense of what people are living through. It's happening really, really close to you. And I think from the point of view of, you know, that can be a really good thing from the point of view of you actually sort of understanding the community that you're reporting on. You know where the low spots in or where the high spots in the river are, for instance. You know where's likely to be affected. But at the same time, you've got your own concerns. You know, you've got worry about whether the water's going to get in under your own house. You've got worry about neighbours and people who you know who might be affected. So it's been a very interesting time for sure.
Lenore, what are the main priorities when reporting on natural disasters like this?
Well, in the first instance, we have a responsibility to get as much important information to readers as we possibly can. So conveying facts, evacuation orders, what's happening, what the bomb is saying about the weather that's coming. We also want to convey human experiences to people who aren't in those areas so they understand what their fellow Australians are going through. But there are a lot of judgments involved in that. So when it's appropriate to talk to people and when you should just let them get on with getting away from floodwaters or doing what they need to do. I remember there was a radio interview on the ABC this week where a woman was in her house and saying that the water was rising. And then she said, oh my God, the fridge is gone. I have to get on the roof now. And the radio interviewer did sort of stop asking questions, but I remember sort of shouting at the radio, please stop now. Let her get on the roof. I think also you always want to find the stories about human resilience and communities coming together. And there are a lot of those stories. You know, people do respond in times of disaster and crisis in a human and heartfelt way to help each other. But I think we have to be careful too about balancing those stories with the fact that this is overwhelmingly a story of loss and trauma. So, you know, one example was this week, Connell Hannah, who's our new States editor, who is actually based in the Tweed, went with local farmers who were going to take supplies down to a group of drivers who were stranded on the M1. And, you know, there are drivers stranded up and down the M1. It turned out that the ones that they went down to were in a relatively good position because there'd been a small kind of tunnel near where they were stranded, so they had some shelter. And they happened to be stranded with a chicken truck, and there were campers who had a cooker, so they'd actually been able to cook food and had not a half bad evening sort of sheltering in this tunnel. That was a fabulous story. I loved that story, but you have to balance it against the fact that most of the hundreds of drivers stranded on the M1 had a really dismal night in the rain and were hungry and thirsty. So balancing those things is another question. And also to what Ben said, there are a lot of local reporters trying to do their jobs while they are themselves impacted by flooding or in communities where they know the people that they're reporting about. You know, that's a really tough thing to do.
One of the things that I kind of noticed while driving around, particularly on Sunday morning, was you were talking to people who were kind of in the midst of this flight response in some aspects. You know, the water was quite literally still coming up. And so I think, you know, you need to make a judgment call about, you know, do we speak to these people? Are they in, you absolutely need to be able to tell people about what that experience is like. But at the same time, you kind of have to be really conscious not to be obtrusive while they're doing that. Some people are, you know, really kind of happy to kind of share those sorts of stories and others just really want to get on with it. So going around and being involved in kind of documenting what that human response is right from the very beginning of this right through to kind of talking through what the kind of those really heightened experiences are when the water is right up and, you know, people have to be rescued and everything else. I think, those sorts of stories, I think, help kind of sheet home the reality of this sort of far beyond the information about rain levels or, you know, what the river peaks at or anything like that.
Mm. And Lenore, you mentioned earlier the importance of reporting the facts. There's been a lot of commentary around this week about what a 1-in-100-year flood means or 1-in-500-year flood means. Weather systems can obviously be very hard to describe, but what do those terms actually mean, Ben?
Well, I mean, the 1-in-100-year flood designation really means that there's a 1% chance every year of a flood of that magnitude having. In Australia, what we tend to do from a planning point of view is plan our cities and our communities and our developments around a 1-in-100-year flood. And what we're seeing in some communities is that this sort of flooding is happening far more regularly than we're expecting it to. So we're talking about these sorts of events in some places happening every 3 years, in some returning every kind of or 10 years. There was some commentary around the level of rainfall that Brisbane had during this last week as being something like a 1-in-1,000-year event. But increasingly, I think these terms are becoming junk in terms of understanding what's happening with weather systems, you know, the simple fact that a flood that we expect to happen, you know, we expect there to be a 1% chance of happening every year is happening more and more frequently, I think is just really raw evidence of a climate emergency occurring right around us. And, you know, I think that there absolutely needs to kind of be a broader thought about whether that kind of 1 in 100 year designation really is the thing that we need to be looking to when these sorts of things happen.
And Lenore, so how do we talk about the climate emergency in our coverage and what responsibility do we have to do that?
Yeah, well, right in the middle of all of this disaster, we got Monday's report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projecting that global warming of 2 degrees Celsius this century would bring twice as much flood damage compared to 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. Mm. And of course, we're not even on track necessarily to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees. And that jumps to 3.9 times more flood damage at 3 degrees Celsius warming. So clearly, global heating is connected to increased frequency and severity of flooding, but we do have to be accurate about how we portray those connections. There hasn't been a formal attribution study of this flood event and global heating yet, but there definitely is a connection. I mean, we know for sure extreme events like this are going to happen more frequently in a warmer climate, partly because the weather system that we're having now, which is something called an atmospheric river. I don't 100% understand what an atmospheric river is, I have to be honest, but it sort of means that an atmospheric phenomenon that sits around for a long time and causes rainfall, that it was happening on top of a more extreme La Nina event than normal, so everything was more waterlogged. And because we know that increased atmospheric temperatures and increased ocean temperatures increase the intensity of rainstorms. If you pull all of those things together, it is very clear that there is a connection between the climate and increasingly severe flooding events. And that's something that climate scientists are going to have more to say about in the coming months. You know, the connection is undeniable. We just have to be careful about how definitive we draw a line between one and the other.
Obviously, we have a responsibility to report on what's happening on the ground, but we also have a responsibility to hold governments to account. What are the immediate and more longer-term questions that we should be asking about this event?
I think that, you know, we kind of need to be looking at things like mitigation, at whether mitigation measures are effective. And as I mentioned before, like a lot of the planning goes into less severe sorts of flooding events than we experience. So do we need to be looking at things like development rules that allow building in areas that we know are flood prone? Do we need to be looking at things like, you know, climate resilience type projects that are designed to try and mitigate these sorts of events, following that sort of a path on a kind of an ongoing basis to make sure that, you know, we don't turn around and simply forget that this happened? I think back at sort of the end of 2019, the start of 2020, we had towns in parts of Queensland who were running out of water because of the extent of the drought. And yeah, I think a lot of questions that we are asking about, you know, broader kind of resilience for these sorts of places have gone away because we have now gone into a La Nina event. We are now talking about flooding everywhere else. And I think rather than just sort of having a kind of a news agenda that sort of oscillates from let's cover the drought, let's cover the floods, let's cover the bushfires, to be able to talk about these things in a kind of a more general sense rather than simply getting caught up in the kind of the immediacy of what's happening, I think is important from that longer term point of view.
I mean, I think there are short term immediate issues. There's the $1,000 disaster recovery payments. There's the question of how often and how reliably insurers pay out to flood affected people. There are equity issues because many of the people we've interviewed have no insurance because premiums were too expensive. And if you can't afford insurance, you're flooded again, you lose everything, there's no recompense, your house value declines because you're in a flood area. The whole thing spirals and becomes a really serious equity issue. So there's a whole bunch of immediate issues like that. Also, questions that came up this week about some of the government's schemes to pay out. So there's a Preparing Australia program, which came out after the Bushfire Royal Commission to fund disaster mitigation. And there were questions about, for instance, why Lismore, which floods, you know, regularly, wasn't initially included in that. There's questions about the bigger disaster fund that the government has, which hasn't paid out a lot of money yet at all. And then, as Ben says, there are these longer term structural issues about these events keep happening. They're going to happen more frequently. How do we plan for that? So I think government spent about 97% of disaster money on recovery and only about 3% on mitigation. But we know mitigation can help, can reduce insurance premiums. For example, in Roma in Western Queensland, where there was a levee built after the 2011 floods, insurance premiums did drop. But it doesn't work everywhere. And I think there are really big questions about that. As floods get more severe, those sorts of levees are going to work less. In Lismore, for instance, you know, there are mitigation things that might help. But to really avoid the damage of a flood like this one, which was sort of 14 metres, you'd need, you know, I think someone said to Peter Hannam in one of our stories this week, you'd need a levee the size of the Berlin Wall. Like, it just wouldn't work. So, you know, in after 2011, that town that was swept away in Queensland called Grantham, many of the families moved up the hill. They rebuilt on higher ground. But then some families couldn't afford it, depending on how insurers paid out and on their own circumstances. That was a small community, a particular circumstance where there was land available. But again, it was an equity issue. Some families got left behind. I think we need to ask those big questions rather than just rebuild where people lived before or increase a dam by a metre or increase a levee by a metre. It's like the whole thing has gone a bit beyond that now.
Well, one of the things we have seen in Queensland, every time we do have a natural disaster here, is an insurance story that comes from that. You know, we've had, there are parts of North Queensland now that struggle to be able to get cyclone insurance because of the frequency of serious cyclones coming through there. We talked to people this week who weren't insured, who lived in a flood-affected area. And the reason that they weren't insured was because it was going to cost them something in excess of $10,000 a year to simply have flood insurance as part of their insurance package. And one of the things we've seen in places like Townsville, which flooded in early 2019, was that, as Lenore says, that equity issue was really, really stark in a place like Townsville, because part of the city is built in a floodplain and it is overwhelmingly, you know, housing for lower income earners, for people who simply can't afford to live in areas that aren't prone to flooding. It was that those sorts of people who were disproportionately affected, and people who are less likely to have insurance, less likely to be able to pay for the bigger premiums. So there is this kind of equity story that will continue to kind of emerge every time we have a natural disaster.
And I think the North Queensland example is really interesting because, as Ben says, they've been going through this spiral for years of cyclone damage and then insurance premiums going up and people then not being able to insure and then another cyclone coming. And after sort of a decade of lobbying, the government last year announced this $10 billion reinsurance pool, which sort of, I think, basically allows insurers to reinsure at a lower cost because the government is taking on some of the risk. The theory being that that will be passed on to householders and businesses in the form of lower, cheaper insurance premiums. There's been no actual modelling of that, and the legislation is still before the Senate, so it hasn't actually kicked in yet. But I do think it raises some really interesting questions. First of all, does it work? I know the ACCC looked at it and did not recommend a reinsurance pool like that. And some people would argue that artificially reducing premiums in that way just means there isn't the price signal to say the risk of living in these places is unacceptably high and we need to think of a different solution. But the bigger question, I think, is why only North Queensland? I mean, Brisbane and northern New South Wales will have spiralling premiums now as well because of the frequency of events. So why is it only North Queensland that is involved in this reinsurance pool? And will these other communities start asking for broader solutions from government like that as well?
I mean, should the government allow housing in areas that are basically uninsurable?
Well, that's a great question. And I know there's been a scheme in outside of Sydney for the government to buy back houses that were built in a floodplain, which has had sort of only limited success. So, you know, I think where we're going is there needs to be a broader reassessment of planning and how the government responds, because just forking out recovery money every other year doesn't seem like a smart way to go.
Mm.
There are difficulties with that sort of thing too. In a place like Newcastle, which went through, and I reported on the, you know, storm in 2007 that brought the Pashabalka tanker right into the beach. Afterwards, the city there responded to that by, you know, there's a $2 billion plan that was designed to try and buy back a lot of the community that was flood prone. I think 70% of that city is flood prone. And what they found was resistance in some pockets of the community too, because people were connected to where they live. And these are issues we're going to have to grapple with in places like Lismore, which is obviously flood prone. It has flooded, you know, multiple times in the last couple of decades. So, you know, how do we reckon with the fact that people love these communities, they have connections to them, they like where they live, they like the people that they live around, yet at the same time, we have to be asking tough questions like whether it is sustainable to continue to live in places that are so susceptible to these sorts of disasters.
We know from previous disasters that it takes a long time for people to recover. But we know that, you know, when the immediate harm, when the flooding abates a bit and the immediate harm goes away, people kind of lose interest a bit. Do we have a responsibility to maintain a focus on those communities and how they're rebuilding their lives?
Oh, we absolutely do. I mean, there are still people living in caravans after the bushfires, and there are all manner of long-term problems and issues. I mean, obviously long-term emotional scarring, but also practical problems. I mean, there is already a huge shortage of building supplies in Australia because of bushfires and other things and supply problems because of COVID and a whole lot of sort of combining factors. I can't imagine what that's going to be like when people start to try to rebuild after this flooding. So I do think that we have a real responsibility to stay on the story because, you know, the floodwaters go down, but the trauma and the personal upheaval for thousands and thousands of people is going to last for many, many years.
I was speaking to some people in Brisbane, but also in Lismore over the last couple of days, talking about the fact that people did still carry that emotional burden from having lived through this sort of a disaster quite recently. In Lismore, the 2017 floods, and they had mental health teams coming through there doing studies that did show that there was a really significant impact on people personally from having gone through something like that. So we're not only talking now about an event that has kind of likely compounded that for so many people, but we're talking about, you know, a need to make sure we don't lose focus on those sorts of things. As you know, the cleanup happens, as, you know, parks and playgrounds and homes and everything get rebuilt, you know, albeit slowly, there are these sorts of bigger issues that we need to keep in focus, certainly.
Next, life imitates art. Now we come to what we can't get out of our head. I think there's one major event happening that probably we all can't get out of our head this week. Lenore, do you want to start?
Yeah, Ukraine. Who can stop reading about Ukraine each day? It becomes more horrifying. But the one thing that I have really focused on and thought about a lot is the amazing leadership of Volodymyr Zelensky. I mean, I knew a bit about him before this. He was the bloke that had played the role of president and then in a sort of a television show and then became president. But watching his selfie videos where he's basically challenging the world to have the courage of their democratic convictions.
Slava нашим захисникам, слава нашим захисницям. Слава.
Rallying the world, rallying his own people, declining Washington's offer to evacuate him because of the extreme threat to his own life, saying the fight is here, I need ammunition, not a ride.
We've hardly slept for 7 nights. Or we sleep, but anxiously. My dears, the time will come when we'll be able to sleep.
I mean, he's human, he's obviously flawed, but it's the most extraordinary example of leadership I've seen in a really, really long time, and such a smart use of social media to get a message across in such an incredibly effective way.
His story is really so fascinating. Mm. I had watched the Servant of the People, the show that he was in, when it was first put on Netflix a few years ago, and sort of missed the kind of the local political story of his rise to the presidency subsequent to that. And remember thinking that I was being trolled when the Ukraine scandal in the US with President Trump occurred, and suddenly here's this guy that you've seen in a TV show suddenly, you know, acting it out for real.
Hello?
Good morning, Mr. Goloborodko. Can I connect you with Angela Merkel?
Yes, you can connect.
Hello. My congratulations. We decided to take your country to the European Union.
Think back when the West Wing was running in the US, there were some opinion polls that spoke to the fact that more Americans wanted a President Bartlet than, you know, perhaps Bush or Kerry, who were running at the time. And the thing that you really pick up watching the show that Zelensky was in is largely kind of how hopeful it was, how kind of an idealized version of a presidency it is. And I think that there's something about that that speaks to the people of Ukraine, who they were, you know, believed they were voting for at that point. Certainly a different narrative to, you know, a President Trump or another kind of celebrity president coming to power, and, you know, just how he has been able to kind of live out people's expectations has been really fascinating.
I don't want to make light of it because I think he's a leader who's really risen to the challenge, but he was so good on Dancing with the Stars.
And all of those funny clips, yeah, I know. But the
amazing
resolve is just amazing. I mean, so much of the Ukraine story is just, you just can't stop reading about it.
Yeah.
And it's just so many heartbreaking, horrific stories. But, yeah, he's fascinating.
Well, thank you both, Lenore and Ben, for joining us today.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks, Gabs.
That's it for today. Thanks to Ben Smee for filling in for Mike Tisher, who is still away but coming back soon. If you liked this episode, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannon. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday. We'll see you then.